Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a job that many of us would salivate over, dining out 8 meals a week at least at some, if not all, of New York City's finest restaurants. But for Frank Bruni, former restaurant critic at the New York Times, food was frequently the enemy. Overindulgence was followed by purging and fad diets. Now he's written a memoir about his lifelong obsession with food. This hour, On Point, the secret life of one of the world's most influential eaters. And you can join the conversation. What are the recipes and food traditions that bring your relatives together? How is your family history, its culture, expressed on your dining room table? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from New York is award-winning journalist and author Frank Bruni. He's just stepped down as restaurant critic for the New York Times after 5 years of that eating. His new book is called Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater. Frank Bruni, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Jackie.
You know, you say at the very beginning of this memoir that you don't have scientific evidence to prove this, but strong anecdotal evidence, and call yourself, and I have to say, when I saw the excerpt in the magazine, a baby bulimic, and I thought, nah, that can't be such a thing.
Well, the phrase is used loosely to introduce a story about a time when I was 18 months old and got through such a violent tantrum in my high chair because my mother wouldn't give me a third big burger that I threw up what I'd eaten already. And it commenced a period when I was young when whenever she would deny me more food, I would throw up more out of upset than anything else. So the baby bulimia phrase is just a way to get into that story, and the story is an illustration of the fact that a lot of us are just born with enormous appetites.
Yeah, well, not only enormous appetites, although yours seems to be just reading about it, incredibly robust and passionate. But it's a symbiosis in one way, shape, or form with something or somebody. And like I think a lot of big eaters, you and your mother together had this complicated relationship with food. Complicated and lovely, we should say. Beautiful. Beautiful food traditions.
Yeah, it was a very two-sided thing. I mean, I had this big appetite, but you're right. It was facilitated and in some senses rewarded by my relationship with both my mother and my grandmother. I write a lot about both of those women in the book, and one of the joys of writing the book was being able to pay tribute to such interesting and loving people as they were. But I realized, I think, more in retrospect than at the time, that by eating as much as I did, which I wanted to do, I also formed bonds with these two women and in a weird way won their sort of approval and favor by loving the food that they were making so much.
Would you read from this, it's page 17 in your book, where you're describing how central the food is to your mom's sense of identity?
Absolutely, sure. Mom was incessantly feeding people, friends who dropped by for a hello, not a ham and cheese omelet, whole second grade classes to which she'd deliver 4 or 5 batches of brownies she had made on a whim the midnight before, people she'd hired to do work around the house. She'd carry broad trays of tuna and egg salad sandwiches, along with deep pitchers of lemonade and iced tea, to men raking leaves in the Soundview yard. She'd insist that the cleaning woman who came once a week stop what she was doing around lunchtime and sit down to a bowl of homemade clam chowder, a plate of homemade chocolate chip cookies, and, if the timing worked out just right, an episode of All My Children. Food was how Mom showed people the amount of time she was willing to spare for them, the sorts of sacrifices she was willing to make for them.
And let's be very clear here. Your mother comes off as a wonderfully loving person.
And I'm glad to hear that.
Well, she does. And who wouldn't want to eat at this table? I mean, she would cook the meals that your grandmother had begun for the family, your grandmother, an Italian immigrant. And you have descriptions of your grandmother sitting in front of sheets of dough, making a little pasta. I'm going to let you tell us the name, where she pinches each one with her thumb so that it has the imprint of her thumb.
Well, yeah, she called them stracciatella, which was an Italian dialect, but I think the savvy Italian diner of today knows them as orecchiette, which means little ears. And they're those kind of concave nubs of pasta, but she would, as you just said, she would make them literally by molding each one of them over her thumb. And the lovely thing about eating them, besides the fact that they were delicious, was you knew that each one of them had spent some time on grandma's thumb. So if food is love, this was the dish that said love more than any other I could imagine.
One of the things that comes through here, though, and where it gets a little complicated and perhaps dangerous, is it's not just that your mom plans for Thanksgiving like a pilot plans his flight plan, but that food becomes a sustaining way of thinking about everything. For example, at one point, she's trying to cook your friends her own version of egg McMuffins and kind of compete with McDonald's, which I thought was great, but kind of bizarre.
Well, you know, food is so central in life, and it's such a central joy in life, but it can become too all-consuming. And that's what I struggled with over time, was finding that balance. How do you, you know, if you're given to overindulgence, and if you love food in the ways that I did, which had that capacity for almost drug-like addiction and excess, how do you integrate it all? And my mother turned cooking into the center of her life. It was the way she, you know, showed everything about what she did, and that was great and beautiful, but it could take someone like me and make him focus inordinately on food and in an ultimately destructive way.
When did you think that perhaps this wasn't a good idea? I mean, early on in your life, you're already chubbier than your brothers. You're bigger than they are. Your waistline's bigger than your younger brothers, than your older brothers. Excuse me, misspoke. And even your mom says you're getting teased at school. Well, if you don't like what that little girl's saying, you could always knock her down and sit on her.
Yeah, that was an example of I was trying to define and bring to light the ways in which we give people the message that they're overweight without necessarily meaning to. I mean, my mom wasn't turning to me and saying, you're a fat kid. But if you know that you're overweight, if you're self-conscious about it, you can hear all of those references to it in those other things. And you can hear what people are really telling you. And it makes you all the more self-conscious and becomes a big problem.
And, you know, you're talking about growing up in the 60s. It's still a pretty coddled time in some ways for kids, or at least for where you were, because, you know, one thing you hear every night is the good humor truck. You get bowls of ice cream in front of the television, and nobody's thinking that you could ever feed a kid too much, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I think we weren't putting as much thought into it then. Now, of course, I think parents, in a very great way, think a lot about what they're feeding their kids, both in terms of the nutritional value, but also in terms of trying to mold them into healthy, sensible, restrained eaters. And I'm not really sure what my parents could or should have done differently, but one of the things I wanted the book to explore, at least anecdotally, is where a child's relationship with food can go wrong. And I think there's probably some good lessons in here for parents trying to navigate those particular waters.
You know, I've read this really witty and fun memoir, and we're going to cover lots more of it in this hour, but if you could pinpoint one thing, I mean, where do you think? Perhaps it's not that easy to just say it was that day, it was that item. I mean, we talked about the good humor truck, but I remember eating Hostess cupcakes by the package and thinking, this is the most perfect food there ever was.
You know, I think I encountered a sort of perfect storm of bad circumstances for overeating, because I do believe I am genetically wired to love food and to love the act of eating food in abundance. I mean, I thrilled not only to individual food items, but I thrilled to the process of eating at length. And it just so happened that this personality, mine, was tucked into this sprawling Italian-American family in which there was such an abundance, a superabundance of food, and such joy at the table and so much reward for a little kid who could shovel all of that in, that I don't think there was really any chance for me not to end up an overeater.
Could you describe just a little bit a typical Thanksgiving?
Oh, well, do you have 5 hours?
This particular part of the show, we have 2.5 minutes, but we can get started and we can always carry on.
No, I know. I'm joking. My mother would plan Thanksgiving for 4 days in advance, and it was this flurry of Post-it notes. And by the time, I mean, everything – was like General Patton sending his troops into battle, only the troops were yams and drumsticks. And but I mean, there would be 12 appetizers. There would be, in addition to the turkey, some other meat, and then there'd of course be a pasta dish, because you couldn't have a holiday without a pasta dish. And the table would never ever, there would never be a moment when there wasn't food on the table. There were things served between the main meal and dessert, because what if someone sitting there happened to want a morsel of food at that moment in time and something wasn't within reach? That was my family's approach to entertaining.
What I loved was your mom would maybe serve yams or ham for someone who didn't want the turkey, but then we need more turkey sandwiches for someone who doesn't want the yams or ham. Endless choices.
The rule in the Bruni family, and my mother came into the Bruni family and you know, within a week could have been born into it. You know, she just absorbed it all. The rule in the Italian-American Bruni family was, when you served food, you had to have enough of every single item that if somebody sitting there wanted to eat that item and only that item, or if everybody did that, there would be enough of that item for everybody. So if you looked at a platter of yams and there were only two left, you were an abject failure, because it might mean that someone had wanted to take one of those last two but had been too shy to, because there might not be enough left for someone else. So you had to have 20 leftover yams, you had to have about 5 pounds of leftover turkey, or you had miscalculated.
And of course, for your grandmother, this is coming after a time of want. So excess.
Yes, this is very much an immigrant food. My grandmother came to the United States from a poor background. And so for her, having a table overloaded with food was a sign of wealth.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking about the self-discipline it takes to be a top restaurant critic and the difference between eating for pleasure, for sustenance, or for comfort, or because it's part of your job, or because you can't stop eating. My guest is Frank Bruni, former restaurant critic for the New York Times and author of Born Round, The Secret Life of a Full-Time Eater. And Frank, I guess we should get to a little bit of a history behind your title. At first, I thought it just meant born chubby, but it means a lot more than that.
My grandmother had a saying, she had a lot of favorite little sayings, and one was, born round, you don't die square. And she meant you just really never change who you are. And part of what the book is about is my attempt to see if, when it came to food and my relationship with food, I could make a fundamental change in who I was and how I behaved.
But you tried to make a fundamental change in ways that were actually destructive, and that led to real bulimia in college, of which you give us, I have to say, there's only one way to say this, an entertaining description. but thank you for doing that. And would you read from it a little bit on page 87, I think?
Okay, I will. Yeah, I'm trying to describe the psychology of how this starts to happen, but upon finishing the salad, I wouldn't be anywhere close to satisfied. I wouldn't be in the same hemisphere as satisfied. And the sound of that dissatisfaction, like a drumbeat in the center of my brain, would grow louder and louder. Pum-pum. I could have had a burger. I had seen the cafeteria workers cooking burgers on a griddle. There were burgers to be ordered. I could have had one. Pum-pum. Macaroni and cheese. There'd been macaroni and cheese. It looked sort of congealed and stiff at the edges. I love it when it's sort of congealed and stiff at the edges. Pum-pum. Remember the smell of the hot oil that still clung to the fried chicken on the food line? And the way the chicken seemed to have a palpable crispness? And yet, the breading didn't look all that thick. Could one piece, a breast, hurt so much? Hadn't Mom always said that white meat was less caloric than dark? I'd go back to the food line. I'd get a fried chicken breast. I'd eat it, and then I'd worry. No, I'd conclude that I'd miscalculated, that I'd eaten too much and would have to get rid of some of what I'd eaten. That decision made, I'd get an ice cream sandwich and a cookie. Two cookies, actually. If I was going to empty my stomach, if I was going to go through all of that messy, beet-faced trouble, I might as well make the most of the buildup, might as well acknowledge and address all my cravings and satisfy them. That way, I'd be less tempted the next day. I'd be less likely to need to throw up.
You know, it is striking to think that eventually you do master this eventually and become a restaurant critic. But while you were in it, the way that you thought you could pass without anybody knowing, which is, of course, the first step in so many types of addictions.
Yeah, no, what ultimately, I was fortunate because my period of bulimia only lasted about maybe 6-7 months. And I ended it because I realized, I was told by friends that people knew what was going on and I was embarrassed by it. I thought I'd had this great, as you said, secret. But bulimia was just one of a long series of quick fixes that I was trying to find. I mean, my history with food was one of always trying to find a cheat, a magic bullet, something that would keep me thin without making me do the hard work of finding the discipline to do portion control and all that. And I think in the end, there is no cheat. There is no quick fix. You just have to learn to restrain your eating in a much more sensible way.
You go on throughout your life. You become a general assignment reporter at the Detroit Free Press, and you work out. You had been actually even a swimmer as a child. You yo-yo a little bit, but the high point of heaviness, if you will, or low point, seems to have come after covering the Bush campaign, and you're only 5'11", or you are, it's a good height for a guy, but I mean, you're 5'11", and you put on 268 pounds, which is a lot.
I was a big boy. Mm-hmm. I was wearing size 42 pants, and it was sort of my worst nightmare had finally come true. I mean, most of my life had been about horrible behaviors to keep this from happening. And in my mid-30s, I just kind of really lost control and spent several years at this massive weight, very unhappy, in retreat from the world in a lot of ways, didn't date, you know, tried to curtail social obligations because I just didn't really like to be among people as much. And that's what I had to pull back from.
Yeah. Why is it, do you think, that in our culture we get entwined with food in an unhealthy way? You obviously, by now, have come to write about it so beautifully and have a different relationship. But when you were in the thrall of all of this, why did you contemplate why you had moved into getting heavy and making these kinds of choices and sort of having it control you?
Well, I think I'd never learned any sort of relationship with food other than, you know, embrace, avoid, binge, purge. So that was already a big problem. And in my mid-30s, it came a few years after some personal hardships due to a couple bad relationships. I was in a sort of retreat. So I think that I not only wanted to eat badly because I was sort of depressed, but as I ate more and more, I became more depressed over what was happening, and it became this vicious cycle.
Yeah. And exercise is really the way that you get out of it.
Yeah, for me it was, and another, you know, you mentioned this happened when I was covering the Bush campaign, and that's an important thing to note too in this, not the Bush campaign, but I also had moved into a lifestyle and a life where I was working 70 hours a week. I didn't have control over my schedule. If you are someone who needs to lose a lot of weight, you need to kind of construct a life that's a little bit less stressful and that gives you more control over your schedule, because you do need to build in things like exercise. You need to ward off the sort of anxiety and stress that are going to have you reaching for food. All of that's really important.
When the New York Times editors called you in Rome and said, "Would you like to become our food critic?" what went through your mind?
Well, the first thing that went through my mind was, I mean, literally the word irony flashed brightly and repeatedly, because of all the people to be asked to make a profession of eating, I was one of the most unlikely ones. But that call came about 3 years after I lost the weight we were just talking about. And I somehow had become pretty sure in that 3 years that I had figured out where I'd always gone wrong with food and how to behave in a better way. And I just knew in my gut, if you'll pardon the phrase, that eating for a living as a restaurant critic might actually work out well for me.
Because you could indulge yourself? Because you could indulge yourself, but only a little? Or how?
Because my mistake in the past had always been I would have these extraordinary pig outs because I'd tell myself, next week I'm going to go on a really strict diet. Tomorrow I'm going to fast. I would tell myself that, but it would be a broken promise and a lie. And I knew that if I had to go out every night and eat a certain decent amount, I would probably stop after that decent amount because I wouldn't be able to lie to myself and say, well, I'm going to go way overboard and diet next week. There is no possibility of a fad diet if you're eating professionally. The only thing you can do is stop eating at a certain point, you know, sensible portion and exercise. So I knew I would do that because I wouldn't be able to tell myself I had some other easier option.
It must have been hard, though, to give up Rome. I mean, when you arrived in Rome, obviously you already had Italian ancestry, you'd studied some Italian. You had a lovely life, and also you had a lovely feeling for Italian food. Maybe you could just tell us your idea of a perfect lunch or lunch routine.
Oh, well, I mean, I had a particular lunch routine I loved in Rome that wasn't so much a meal, a conventional meal, but I used to go and our office was right near Campo dei Fiori, which is one of the nicest places in Rome to shop for food. And I would go and I would get some fresh out of the oven pizza bianca, which is sort of like pizza without anything on it. It's like the bread or the crust without anything else, although sort of half focaccia too. And then I would walk from the Pizza Bianca place to one of my favorite cheese shops, and I would get creamy sheep's milk ricotta, freshly made. And then I would take those over to a stone bench in Piazza Farnese, and right with the sound of a fountain and the motorini going by, I would kind of construct, I would spread the ricotta on the Pizza Bianca and just kind of eat that in the open air. That was my favorite Roman meal.
I really just wanted to hear you say that.
In fact, I've been back to
Thanks
Rome
for getting
a couple
me
times.
The meal.
I've been back to Rome a couple times since I moved, and there's always an afternoon where I make sure I do that. It's just this, it just makes my heart sing.
Well, we have so many people calling in, but I wanted to ask, when you think about writing professionally, can you love food the same way you did when you were sitting on that bench and you didn't have to think about it as a professional occupation?
You know, you can, and that surprised and delighted me. I was a movie critic many years ago, and when I turned what was a passion, seeing movies, into writing about movies, I leached a lot of my joy away. Subsequent to that stint, 2.5 years as a movie critic, I've never watched as many movies. I left the reviewing job a couple weeks ago. I stopped visiting restaurants for reviews a few weeks before that, and I find myself still eating out in restaurants just about every night. There's something about my love of food that's just kind of big and nimble enough that that it works whether I'm by that fountain eating Pizza Bianca or whether I'm at a table having to try 12 different dishes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a call. Sean is calling from Wolcott, Connecticut. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Jackie. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, I want to call. I work as a firefighter, and food's important to us because you know, we live in the firehouse for many hours a day. Right now we're doing 24-hour shifts, and I've learned to cook. You're talking to a guy who used to burn boiling water. And I've learned to cook and really enjoy the food and try to make it important to the guys, you know, whether it's a local tradition meal that we have that spreads throughout the firehouses and put my own twist on it, or trying to create new things for the guys to, you know, enlighten and enjoy the food. In fact, I created a Facebook page, Firehouse Cooks. I love cooking so much.
Wow. But you know, in firehouses, I'm sure Frank knows this too, it is one of the most fantastic places to eat. And food really bonds people.
Yes, definitely. And we sit around and we talk, we joke, you know, and it's a time to come together. You know, be part of it because it's another family that we have.
Frank, what do you think about preparing food that way or at your Thanksgiving table? And how much of a distance is it between what Sean's talking about or what your mom did and what Thomas Keller is doing at a French Laundry restaurant in California?
You know, I don't think there's much difference at all. Food has for, you know, centuries, millennia, whatever, it has been this sort of binder. It's this thing that brings us together, and the act of eating is something that I think people have always gravitated to doing in groups. It's social glue. Food gives us that moment to come together and relate to each other, and that's true whether it's four people eating the, you know, the most haute cuisine at the French Laundry, or whether it's the guys in the firehouse, or whether it's the Bruni family at Christmas Eve. It's sort of food sort of greases the wheels of our social interactions.
Let's hear from Robina. She's calling from White River Junction, Vermont.
Hello, Jackie.
Hi, Robina.
Thank you for talking with me.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to On Point.
What I wanted to talk about, what I felt a real correspondence about, was the I have a very problematic relationship with food from my young teenage years all the way up until my mid-30s. And it was through a very wonderful relationship with a gentleman who ate out very, very frequently that I was able to come to really understand my relationship with food and learn to not associate it with love or acceptance, but just learn to relax and to enjoy companionship with food and see food more as a companionship in my life versus it having to be about my dress size or anything else like that. And it has, and since then, for the past 14 years, it has become just a part of my life that is essential without becoming a demon. And I have just really loved listening to what your author has had to say. I have just loved this very much.
How often do you go out to restaurants now?
Very frequently, actually. I eat out about between, I'd say, 10 to 15 times a week.
Really? And you're happy, I take it, with your, what is it, Frank, the body mass index or something like that?
Yes, actually I am. I have a very active lifestyle. I eat what I want. I eat what I like. I do not go out to these restaurants to eat broiled chicken and salad that you just wave a dressing in front of. But I do have a pretty good understanding of stopping when I'm no longer don't need to eat anymore. I just eat, you know, when the pleasure button has popped up and said, okay, this is good, I don't need any more, then that's when I stop, because I'm not eating for any other type of fulfillment. It's taken care of with the company and the whole situation, as opposed to just focusing on one part. And that's something that I never had when I was younger.
Okay, thanks, Robina. So Robina was able to change her relationship. You know, I was just thinking about how we eat. Even as a restaurant critic, one of the things, and I want to get into that more in the next part of our show, how you did it, but you didn't eat alone, which kind of surprised me. I guess I thought that restaurant critics were all, not only refertive, which you were, but that they also ate solo.
No, almost never, because one of our goals when we sit down in a restaurant is to kind of cover a lot of the menu, you know, to try as many different dishes as possible. So you bring other people with you because you tell everybody to order something different and you share food, and that way you conquer more of the menu per visit.
Well, that sounds like great terrain. Are you going to – do you think that you have a predilection for top restaurants or – any kind of good food?
I'm pretty equal opportunity. Depending on my mood, I can be as happy or more happy in a very bare bones casual restaurant as in a very fussy one. I really like it all, and one of the things I love about restaurants is just how the diversity of them allows us to work with a given mood or to satisfy a given mood.
Mm-hmm. Let's take one more call. Brad is calling from Fort Mill, South Carolina. Brad?
Hi, how are you, Jackie?
Good, thanks.
Good. Hey, I have, my sister was a raging bulimic for about 6 years, and she was actually in Duke Hospital for quite a while. And my question to you is, during that bulimic period, did you have some noticeable mental effects? What were you feeling mentally? Because my sister would have these fits of rage so much that as younger siblings, we were afraid to be left alone with her in the home.
Okay.
That's how bad her fits of rage were.
Okay. Thanks, Brad. Frank, can you answer that quickly? Because we just have a little bit of time left here.
Yeah, I had nothing like that. I did have some pretty severe mood swings, but I think it was a sort of whole complicated thing going on right there where I was, you know, depressed somewhat, but nothing like what your sister went through.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking about the rules of the restaurant critic game, the glamour, the influence, and the politics, and why eating and writing about good food captivates our imagination. My guest is Frank Bruni, former restaurant critic for the New York Times and author of Born Round, The Secret Life of a Full-Time Eater. And Frank, let's take a call from Loretta. She's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Loretta. You're on Point.
Hi, Jackie. Mr. Bruni, I have to tell you that I have enjoyed your reviews for the last 5 years, not only because of the restaurant review, but because of your wonderful use of language, the literacy of the articles, the irony, the satire, the metaphor. And I think that you just have an exquisite talent for, you know, writing. And so that is something that I have just been amused by, no matter whether I want to, whether I'm interested in the restaurant or not, or the food or not. You have been so wonderful to read. And I do hope that the New York Times has enough money left to hire someone who has as wonderful a command of language, who makes these just literary essays. I've just enjoyed it immensely. Thank you so much. I'm going to miss you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Thanks. You've made my day. Thank you.
You seem speechless there, Frank. So I thought I'd answer for you. Well, you know, I had a question about that as well, Frank, your successor. When you got the job, the Times sent you on these unbelievable gastronomical tours around France and Italy and Asia. Will that be the case for the person who comes next?
I'm not exactly sure what, I mean, he's doing that right now. His name is Sam Sifton, and to reassure the caller, he's a fantastic writer, so I think she'll be very happy with his reviews. I don't think he's doing as much travel as I did or as my predecessor did, because these are different economic times. But I believe he's doing a bit of it. I'm just not sure what his exact itinerary is.
But, you know, what Loretta was saying about your columns, and I completely agree, you're an absolutely sparkling and vivid and precise and precise writer. And I was thinking as I about the columns as I was reading the memoir, thinking that perhaps writing about food is a bit like writing about painting, because you're writing about the elements and their composition.
Well, it's such a challenging form of writing, because you're trying to bring an experience that is so beyond words, I think. I mean, the act of eating is such a sensual and intimate act, and trying to kind of bring those sensations alive to someone who's just reading about it on a page, be it a newspaper page or a book page, it's very difficult. But I think in that challenge, you can have an enormous amount of fun, and you can really stretch as a writer.
And there was one restaurant that you took your I think it was your brother and sister-in-law to, in California, a Thomas Keller. Was this French Laundry?
That was the French Laundry, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us what happened there.
Well, I was only a couple weeks into the job and was not yet accustomed to being recognized by chefs who put, you know, when we can talk about this, but they put a lot of energy into being able to recognize the New York Times restaurant critic.
I bet.
And we were there, and we hadn't expected to be recognized. We didn't realize it, but the waiter said, you know, would you like, instead of ordering from the menu, would you like to just have the chef cook for you tonight? And that's something a restaurant of the caliber of the French Laundry does with a couple VIP tables a night. And we thought, oh, okay, well, we have a very late reservation. Maybe they had no VIP tables tonight, and so we're just like the lucky lottery winners. They're just going to, you know, roll out the red carpet for us in a sort of random way. So we said, fine, sure, let's see what Chef Keller can do. And thus commenced, I think, about a 4.5-5-hour meal with maybe 25 courses, each with its own wine pairings. And every single course we got, it wasn't that we would all get the same thing. If it was the egg course, each of us would get a different dish. If it was the guinea hen course, each of us would get a different treatment of guinea hen. So you're talking about 75 different dishes just for these three diners at this table. And it was a display of kitchen virtuoso that was so extreme it almost seemed like caricature, but very enjoyable.
Although you did admit that neither you nor your brother Harry could sleep after that.
You know, when you eat that amount of food, and when the food's that good, you do not stop taking bites, no matter how well you've learned to be a disciplined eater. Yeah, I mean, there was so much food in my stomach, and I mean, I remember, I don't think I slept for the next 24 hours.
Let's take another call. Ross is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Ross.
Hello, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
First I want to say it's a privilege to be able to talk to Mr. Bruni. And secondly, I just want to share with him the fact that I ate at Le Bernardin about 2 months before he awarded it its third four-star rating, and his article on the restaurant just made my experience there that much more endearing to me, and that I got my menu framed as well as the article.
Wow.
So, thank you for that. But what I was calling in to say is that I am a chef, and was wondering if we ever have an off night where one of my guys cuts himself, or I'm down two or three men, and we do the best we can to put out the best plates, food, and product that we can. Hopefully there's no mistakes made on the plate that someone like Mr. Bruni receives. But does he have any knowledge of, say, after the fact that the restaurant was having an off night? And is there any sympathy awarded at that point for that off night? Or is it we're just pretty much screwed?
If I'm doing a formal review of your restaurant, you're actually not pretty much screwed, because one of the it's a great, great question, by the way. And I think it is a problem that some of the places that do restaurant reviews, especially now with all of these people doing their own restaurant reviews on the internet, one of the problems is people write based on a single visit. At the Times, we have a long tradition that when we're doing a formal review that has a star rating and all the economic consequences that can come with a star rating, you visit the restaurant at least 3 times before writing. And I probably visited most of the restaurants I reviewed an average of 4 times. And one of the reasons you do that is not just to kind of work your way across the menu and to determine how consistent a restaurant is, but it's also so that if there is that random visit that was bad, that may have been bad for reasons I can't see, you know that that was the exception and not the rule, and you know to kind of dismiss it as an example.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Janos is calling from Barre, Vermont, and I hope that comforted Ross, by the way. Hello, Janos.
Yes, Jackie. Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Frank.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Welcome to the program.
Yes, I'm Hungarian. I'm not Italian, but my parents came over and they were poor, and their treasure was the largest they could provide at the groaning table for all the people who came. And I was wondering, since you mentioned that in the beginning, that was a situation that you had experienced, and the treasure of that incredible food, when you became famous and you went out to fancy restaurants. I mean, I worked at Beverly Hilton, Century Plaza as a high-class waiter, and I was wondering if you noticed that extremely affluent people would savor a well-put-together meal as much as you, who were raised with the meal being a treasure. I've noticed a lot of extremely wealthy people leave half of it there and just talk and smoke, and it was like they never seem to get into the savoring of the meal. Have you noticed that?
Savoring.
I don't know that I see why you're asking the question. It's almost if you're accustomed to that for your whole life, and it doesn't seem as eventful to have an enormous amount or a great banquet, can you ever appreciate it as much? I mean, that's a kind of logical question to ask, but I think food love and love of the act of sitting down to a good meal, I think that transcends background and class. I think there's something almost primal about it, and I think it's more a function of personality type than it is class, I think. But, I mean, I haven't done research on this.
Frank, I had a question for you. You write in the early part of this book that at one point when your food obsession seemed to be taking over you, that you actually would get up in the middle of the night and make meals.
Yeah. at the time, I didn't have a name for it, but I later came across reference to the phenomenon in an article, and it is called sleep eating, and it's like sleepwalking, except you're eating. And it would happen to me on nights after days when I had eaten very, very little, when I had like decided I'm going to take off a bunch of pounds, and so I would have this ridiculously ascetic day in which maybe I'd have 900 calories and go on a 4-mile run. And the sleep eating that would happen as a result at night, when I would literally get out of bed and begin feeding myself without realizing what I was doing, it was an example of my inability to find any sort of equilibrium and any sort of sensible rhythm to eating. I was always eating way too much or way too little.
It doesn't happen anymore, I guess.
Oh, no, no, no. Because I don't, you know, the thing is, and this is where restaurant criticism as a sort of practice and metaphor has been a great healthy way for me to eat. I don't hold myself to unreasonable standards anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't tell myself that I'm going to eat 1,200 calories tomorrow because I've never been able to eat only 1,200 calories. And as a result, I don't have those midnight pig outs because I've deprived myself more than I could really sustain.
David Sedaris, in blurbing this book, talked about frites, which was one of the treats that your grandmother would make, false mustaches, which you've worn into restaurants, he says, and sleep broiling. In warmth, breath, and beautiful writing, Born Round is, to borrow a phrase, Flintstonian, which I thought was great. Anna is calling from Wayland, Massachusetts, and she has a question. Anna?
Hi, Jackie. I was calling to see if there is a last meal that you know you would have if you were, like, getting the chair or something like that.
What have I done to deserve the chair? No.
Overeating.
Something while you were sleep broiling.
Yeah, I did it in my sleep, exactly.
How about just a perfect meal, Frank?
Well, no, I'll answer your question. Actually, I think that there's something, if it was only one meal, I honestly think I would want a fishbowl-sized gin martini, classic martini, and I would want the world's biggest, most fat-stippled, crunchy on the outside, perfectly charred porterhouse steak. Because there's just something so elemental about a martini and a steak.
Classic taste. I think my husband would go along with that. Tom's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Jackie. I just wanted to ask your guest, as a professional critic, how does he feel about the influence of Yelp and Chowhound as all these unprofessionals weigh in?
Yelp and Chowhound, these types of sites or apps that tell you how to eat, these kinds of things.
You know, I think they're great if they're perceived and used in the right way. I mean, I think it's wonderful that we have access to a lot of people's reports and information, and we can really learn a whole lot more about the places that we're considering going out to eat. But I think it's really important that consumers of this information realize that there's a big difference between a newspaper or magazine critic's formal review of a restaurant and what you see on Yelp. You don't know when you're looking at the internet and at a lot of these dispatches, you don't know if you're hearing from someone who's the cousin of the chef. You don't know if you're hearing from someone whose meal was comped. And when you're reading the work of an established critic working for a publication that has established standards, at least you know there's no economic investment. You know that the review is based on more than one meal. So you have to see the different kinds of information in their different contexts.
Phyllis is calling from Hanover, New Hampshire. Phyllis?
Hi, Jackie. Hi, Frank. I love the program. I read the New York Times food section every week, even though I live in Hanover, New Hampshire now. I was brought up in a Jewish family in Brooklyn, New York, so food was a center to us, and it's always been very important to me. I have my own gourmet food business now, and both of my children that are grown, one is a food editor and one is a graduate of the CIA, the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park. So they certainly, took the message of the family and carried it on. My question for Frank, and food is, you know, it's my body is a temple, and it's feeding the soul, and I'm so happy to be living now in Hanover, New Hampshire, and close to Vermont, where we can get the freshest, best everything, meat, cheeses, and everything, and it's really becoming a good movement. My question for Frank is, what are you going to do next?
I'm staying with the Times. I'm going to be writing full time for the Times of Sunday magazine. I imagine I'll continue to write some about food, but as I think we've made reference to in the past, I've also written about politics, international affairs, and so at the magazine I'll be able to do sort of all of it in constant rotation.
You know, I was thinking, Frank, you did this a long time. I think you did it a bit longer, if I'm not mistaken, than William Grimes did. And
I did, yes, that's right.
Yeah, and ate out so often that it really seems tough to have done it for that long.
It was tough. You know, it's the scheduling of it becomes very grueling, and there's not a lot of spontaneity in your life. If you're dealing with hard-to-reserve New York restaurants, you're making your plans and setting your tables up weeks and weeks in advance. So you miss out on a lot of social things because you have to be in X restaurant on Y night, and there is no yielding, you know?
Yeah. And I enjoy the story of the time you showed up. You were always giving false names. You showed up at a restaurant with had friends meeting you and couldn't remember what your name was supposed to be that night.
It happens. You also come up with some ridiculous false names because when you're on the spot, your brain seizes up, you know?
Okay, like, so what's your favorite?
Favorite horrible
favorite
name?
Favorite horrible name.
You know, I was this is a horrible story, but there was a week when I was using the name Paul Gentile, which is an Italian name, G-E-N-T-I-L-E. And I was saying it in my head constantly as Gentile, Gentile. And that week I reserved at a kosher restaurant using that name. So it ended up looking in the reservation book to the hostess as Paul Gentile. And it must have seemed like some ridiculous bad joke, and it was a total, total coincidence.
And did your false mustaches and wigs, did they never fall off?
I only did those a couple of times, and they never fell off. But the one night I was wearing a false mustache, I kept on pressing my finger against it to make sure it was in place. And the woman, my guest, sitting opposite me, was so convinced I was telling her she had food on her lip that she kept wiping ever more vigorously at her lip every time I touched my mustache, and it looked like some, you know, Abbott and Costello culinary routine.
I'm sure your mother would really be proud to know what you have done with food.
I hope so.
Well, thank you very, very much for this enchanting and delightful and honest memoir and for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Frank Bruni. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio to learn more about Born Round, the secret history of a full-time eater. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.